24/7 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. It is Thursday, October 3rd. We're almost there, almost to the weekend. You will make it, I promise. We have a great show today. Two fantastic guests. Keith Hansen is with us. He is going to talk about the Israeli pager attack that happened a week or so ago against the Hamas fighters. If you don't know the story, we will tell it to you in depth. It's so cool. I wanted to learn more about it and find out how they had done it. Keith is a longtime law enforcement specialist, trainer, all of the certifications, all of that. And so he is a fantastic source. And then Wayne Elliott will be back for our weekly dose of Strauss Naturals education. We're going to talk about his heart attack today and a lot of other things about getting ISO certified, some stuff like that. Great stuff with Wayne, as always. We sure do appreciate him and look forward to his visits. And then tomorrow, maybe one of my favorite guests ever, Betty Liu is with us. She is the founder of Confetti Snacks, has raised a bunch of venture capital for a snack food company. I hope you understand how rare, weird, unusual that is. Snack food companies don't raise venture capital money usually. Just unbelievably rare. Very quickly, I wanted to tell you another story about the Israeli Defense Forces. This is from decades ago, and I'm sure I'll have many factual errors. I heard it a long time ago, so it's not accurate. Don't quote me. But the Israelis tricked Hamas into planting a particular tree by every one of the hideouts, and the Israeli forces knew exactly where all the hideouts were because they were planting trees saying, "Here we are." We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. I saw something in the news that happened in Israel, and I was blown away by the audacity of the plan and wanted to find out more about it. And so I reached out and found someone who could tell us. Please welcome Keith Hansen. He is a seasoned law professional and a trainer with so many certifications and specializations. I could read the list for an hour. Basically, anything involving law enforcement, counterterrorism, he is an expert in. He has also recently been appointed the chief executive officer of QUX Technologies, which makes a really cool TV subscription broadcasting box that I hope we'll have time to talk about that as well. Keith, welcome. How are you doing today?
I am great. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. All right. So give us the rundown of what happened in Israel. Tell us the story.
Well, we're talking about the exploding pagers, and the exploding walkie-talkies. So it's actually I have to be honest. You know, whether or not. Well, let me preface this by saying this. In my 24 years in law enforcement, there are times that I look at a crime, and I say, you know, I don't condone this behavior. I don't approve of this behavior, but I really, really have to give their planning, a lot of credit, because there are times when you're really struck by just how brilliant some people can be. And so I don't care what side of the aisle people are on, pro-Israel, I mean, I do care because I think there's right and wrong, but from the perspective of looking at this, I don't think anybody, irrespective of the position that they take, can really discount how incredibly brilliant what Israel, specifically the Mossad, did in this particular case. this is what is called a package intercept. And it's, again, it's brilliant. So these pagers and these walkie-talkies were manufactured in Taiwan. They were introduced into the logistics or shipping chain. They went to Hungary, where they sat for several weeks, in some instances, a couple of months. And this was a special order that was placed specifically for Hezbollah to distribute to their operatives. So the Mossad did exactly what the American CIA has done for years around the world. It's called a package intercept. You know where the package is going to be. And I'll use a parallel example. So the Medellin cartel, the drug cartels, they know that an accountant or somebody who handles logistics for this drug cartel just ordered a new computer. So they intercept the package along its shipping route. They create a disruption. They create something that allows them to access that package. The package is then taken to a location where it's very, very carefully opened. The contents of the package are removed, and then certain things are targeted. Now, in this parallel example, this would be replacing the motherboard on that computer with a mirrored motherboard that is very similar to or virtually identical to the original, with one thing. It has spyware or malware undetectable to the operator built into that system. That motherboard now is replaced. It goes into the new computer. The new computer is expertly repackaged. There is no indication whatsoever, and these people are very good at what they do, that computer is repackaged. It appears as though it is brand new, that the factory seals are intact. And then now with this altered motherboard, it goes to its intended recipient. The recipient opens it up. Everything looks good. They use the item as the item was intended. And unbeknownst to them, there's a piece of spyware or surveillance equipment that was built into that device. That's exactly what happened in the package intercept. And we know this because several of the unexploded devices have been forensically examined. And it's because of those forensic exams that we know that a small quantity of PETN, which is a very, very high explosive, was placed, and small quantities. We're talking, you know, basically about 2 or 3 grams. And what they also did was they were able to put small little pellets or BBs or things like that around that explosive charge. So that way there, when the electronic signal is sent to the device is instructed to detonate. And now with shrapnel built in, it increases the damage or the lethality of that device. So that's exactly, in a nutshell, what happened. And again, this is it's a brilliant idea because you're able to target very specific individuals while minimizing, never eliminating, but minimizing the negative impacts or the harm to innocent third parties, because Israel doesn't want to target women and children. They're not Hezbollah. Hezbollah loves targeting women and children because, well, it's a political statement. That's what terrorism is all about. That's also one of the reasons why, when you look at some of the pro-Hezbollah individuals and entities that are around the world, and they say, well, this is an act of terror. Well, it's not an act of terrorism. It doesn't violate international law because this was not an air fingers quote crime that was perpetrated against women and children. This was an act of war, if you want to call it that. But specifically, it was targeting members of an organization that are, at their core, a terrorist organization. And they were able to, as close to as possible, conduct surgical strikes against those operatives while minimizing the risk that they posed to women or children or innocent third parties who just happened to be in the vicinity. Of course, you know, you're going to have some people who are injured because of shrapnel, some people that were injured because of perhaps percussion injuries. But the fact remains is that they were able to target individuals while doing the best that they possibly could to downplay injuries to innocent third parties. So for that, you have to say, I mean, it really is a brilliant move. Say what you will about, you know, the fact that they're engaging in this back and forth, which seems to be this perpetual "I got you last" cycle. But the concept behind the package intercept and how they did that, I think, is absolutely brilliant.
How did they distribute the pagers or make sure the pagers were distributed to bad guys?
Well, because this was an order for manufacture that was specifically by the organization itself. So this was not; these were not devices that were going to, humanitarian groups or to individuals or to citizens. This is an order that was at least on its surface made for distribution to the operatives. So I mean, it would be the same thing if IBM goes out and buys a bunch of laptops. Are they making a charitable donation to an elementary school, or are they buying laptops so that way their employees have computers on the go? It's pretty easy to figure that out. And of course, you know, you're talking about the operatives in this particular case being Mossad. It's a fairly good guess that they did their homework and their due diligence prior to actually conducting this package intercept campaign.
And how did they know about the campaign or the order in the first place? Was there a spy on the inside? How did they know about the order that intercepted in the first place?
Well, intercepted communications would be the most likely. So they're monitoring communications. They see that an order is placed for, you know, however many, I don't know what the number is, but let's just pick a number, 3,000 pagers. The supply chain or the individuals who are responsible for the supply chain for this organization. Remember, this isn't an ad hoc group. This is a dedicated group. So they have people who are handling acquisitions. They have people who are handling logistics. They have people who are handling communications. So it would make sense that the Mossad would be, as to the best of their ability, monitoring all of those communications. They see that an order is placed. They know exactly where it's going. They know exactly now. They can trace and track where that information is coming from. And the game of intelligence is all about finding people who are now resources. So it's entirely possible that, you know, maybe you had a Mossad operative who knows somebody in the factory. Strike up a little romantic relationship with them, gain their trust, and extract information from that asset. That's again, this is something that intelligence agencies have been doing since the dawn of time, is formulating assets, striking relationships up with people who can then provide information necessary to the fulfillment and the success of the mission. But I mean, with everything being electronic today, to be honest with you, it's not that difficult to track shipments, to track orders, to track packages. I mean, sometimes it's as easy as picking up the phone and saying, hey, my name is so-and-so and I represent this organization. What's the status of our order? Oh, it's in transit. It's amazing how much information you can get when you simply ask for it.
I heard that there was something special about the time they chose for the devices to explode. Did you hear anything about that, that it was scheduled for later, but they had to move it up because of something? And that's what I'm asking about. Do you know what happened there?
I don't, in terms of the specific time or why the time was chosen, right, or any of the story behind that, I'm not familiar with any of that. I've heard rumblings, but not enough to where I would feel comfortable speculating and commenting on it.
And then there was a second attack also, right?
Yes. So the first wave was pagers, the second was walkie-talkies.
Wow.
And again, when you start talking about the brilliance of the plan, now there's two things. Number one, I mean, it's a very, very coordinated attack that targets specific people within an organization. Reach out and touch somebody literally remotely. But I think the other thing too now is that you look at the civilian populations. These people are being targeted. They're not being attacked. But what they are doing now is there is a disruption in how they live their lives. And when you look at terrorism, what is the goal of terrorism? I mean, there's always a goal. We want, you know, people freed, or we want our side to be heard, or we want to exact revenge. But the bottom line is that the goal of terrorism, the unspoken, unwritten goal of terrorism, is to disrupt the social, political, and economic systems of the targeted population. And they've done that because people are now unplugging their televisions. They're unplugging. They don't know how these attacks were launched. They just know that there were lethal attacks that were launched using electronic devices. So now there is a fear that anything, how, maybe my toaster is going to blow up, or maybe my television set is going to blow up. A lot of people don't know how these attacks were launched. And so out of fear, it now causes them to change how they live their daily life. So there's a lot of disruption above and beyond just the disruptions that you're seeing as a result of these devices having been targeted and that specific plan having been put into motion.
Yeah, but your toaster, you went out and bought that alone at the store, whereas you were given the pager by an organization. So I don't think the toaster, you know, if you thought about it for 2 seconds, the toaster's not a likely suspect.
Well, I mean, you're talking about, right, but that's the result of deductive logic. But we're talking about people, a lot of people, I mean, hell, look at our own country. Deductive logic isn't something that's common. It's called common sense, and there's not a lot of common sense. If there were, you wouldn't have Harris and Walt standing up there saying, we don't want more, 4 more years of what we've had. So there are adults out there that are going to vote for these idiots. So I think it's pretty easy to say that you have a very, very impressionable general public who lacks a lot of critical thinking skills. This is very easy to do. Very easy to do.
As a law enforcement expert, what are your take on the 2 Trump assassination attempts? Are they connected? Is there something else, another layer going on here, or was it just 2 crazy wackos?
Well, here's the thing. There's not a lot of information about these attacks. There's the information that's being put out. I'm part of a consortium of tactical operations trainers and curriculum developers. So we generally get first crack at a lot of the after action reports that are coming out. And there's still, I can tell you kind of from the inside view, there's not a lot of information coming out of Butler. The initial attack, and there's even less information coming out about the attack in Florida, the thwarted attack, we'll call it that. I mean, it was an attack. Listen, the bottom line is it was an attack, whether it was physical or whether it was psychological. You had a person that was armed with a rifle that got way too close to the president, number one, and number two, that was an egregious failure of security because the security teams and the multiple layers of security that were there ostensibly to keep Trump safe, failed to do their job. With the lack of information, unfortunately, that winds up killing the fertile grounds where seeds of conspiracy theory can grow. And that's why we see a lot of conspiracies. So you hear a lot of people, and that's not to use the word conspiracy as a pejorative, because I think it's logical. People want answers. They want information. They want to understand what's happening. And when you have limited information, the brain, through a process called confabulation, plugs in what makes the most sense. And so people, you know, now come up with their own conclusions. They arrive at their own deductions based upon the limited information that we have. So whether it's part of a larger conspiracy or whether or not these are just individuals, the bottom line is that you have incendiary, inflammatory rhetoric that is coming out of the progressive left in this country. And that message is being received by mentally defective people who feel as though they now have received their individual marching orders and are going to go out and solve these problems. Because remember, since the day that Trump descended the escalator in Trump Tower, this guy has been called a Nazi. He's been called Hitler. He's been called a threat to democracy. He's been the subject of many campaigns that are not veiled threats. They are actual threats. And when I say that, I mean Kathy Griffin, that reprehensible wench of a failed comedian, standing there with the severed head effigy, bloody, of Trump. When you think of Madonna standing there, I have given thought many times to blowing up the White House. When you hear Maxine Waters telling people that when you see a Trump supporter, to confront them in the supermarkets and the grocery stores, in the gasoline stations, that message is received by mental defects who then go out and act upon that rhetoric. And you can't tell me that, this is just the Democrats speaking in metaphors. No, the Democrats want this guy dead. They want him dead. And there's a lot of people, I believe, around the world that want this man dead. Why? Because he represents an existential threat to the way that business is conducted in Washington and to what our state of politics in this country has become. We are not a constitutional republic anymore. We're turning into a fourth world failed state. What is law and order today?
Keith, let's switch gears. Tell us about QUX.
So you kind of gave a very generalized introduction when you were talking about QUX with a box. The least of what we do is a TV box. QUX is based upon unbreakable, unhackable, quantum-level encryption that by today's standards cannot be broken by any known computer. So whether it's enterprise solutions building out encryption programs for companies that are trying to safeguard their information, or whether or not it's actually developing hardware and extracting the materials for hardware to create secure ecosystems, in a very, very generalized sense, that's a little bit more about what QUX does. The nice thing about this is that any of the systems either that are inherent to QUX or that are now the subject of rebuilds with our enterprise system, there is no data that is aggregated, there is no data that is logged or stored, and it's not hackable. So the beautiful thing about this is that hackers can't target information because there's nothing to target. Hackers couldn't get into the system, even if there happened to be that proverbial informational pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. They can't access that. And the other thing, too, and this is probably a conversation for a different day, but AI systems cannot operate within our ecosystem. And the biggest threat to the individual security and privacy online, besides hackers, is now AI bots that are allowed to run free within these systems, aggregate data, collect data, and then extract that data for behavioral analytical purposes.
Interesting. And what about the broadcast features?
As far as the box goes?
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, as far as that goes, there's three different packages of television programs that people can subscribe to. They are secure. What that means is that we're not tracking your data. And so your information is not being aggregated and sold to marketing companies. And one of the interesting things when you buy pretty much anything today, we have this concept, this Internet of Things, where everything is connected. I bought a printer the other day, and I couldn't use my printer without creating an account. Everything that you buy today, create an account. Why do I need to create an account to use a set of surround sound speakers or to print documents out with a printer that I'm attaching to my desktop? It's because all of that information is aggregated. All of that information is sold. And an overwhelming number of companies that exist today, part of their revenue model, now some, that is their revenue model, but many of these companies, the majority of these companies, have at least a revenue stream that is derived from the sale of individual user data. Whatever you put into that, and oftentimes your activities within that ecosystem, that is being aggregated and it's being sold. So what you watch on television, it is being tracked. It is being monitored. And people say, well, you know, I'm just a plumber. I work 9 to 5. I come home, I have dinner, and I sit down and I watch Fox News or I watch whatever, MSNBC or whatever. Why does anybody care? Well, because the more that I know about you individually and collectively, the more that I can predict what your behavior is. So that makes it a hell of a lot more appealing to marketing companies because I know what you like. And because everything is connected, now I know what you drive. I know what your driving habits are. I know what your viewing habits are. You use your discount card at the supermarket, so I know what you eat. I know what you purchase. I know everything about you. And I think what's really scary is when people find out exactly how much individual data is available about them. Even people who are just seemingly benign. I just go to work and I come home and I eat and I go to bed. Why would anybody possibly want to know about me? Well, because you're a product. And the more that I know about you, the more that I can control you. That's really ultimately what it boils down to. So when you hear people talking about ESG scores and social credit scores, and people say, oh, that's absolutely ridiculous. No, nobody would ever do that. Well, I would bring two things up. Number one, the risk model that's associated with your driving habits. When you go to get car insurance, some people have low rates, some people have high rates. Geez, that must be an unbelievably daunting task to get driving information on every single person with a driver's license. Yet they do it. It's called your driver score. They do it when you apply for credit. Some people can't get a credit card. Some people can go out and with a signature get $100,000 worth of credit. How is it possible? Well, that guy who's sitting in his chair discounting that anybody would want information about them forgets the fact that clearly they're important enough to have a credit report. And that credit report involves risk modeling. It's not how good you are at paying your bills. It's the inverse. It's what is the financial risk that you create to a bank or a lender if they give you an installment loan or a revolving line of credit. The more that I know about you, the more that I can control your behavior or guide your behavior. And ultimately, when you think about today, everything is monetized. So the purpose of having that information is to control, to predict, and to monetize. And I think the way that we're going right now, it's not the question that I think. I know, based upon the industry that I'm in, that a social credit score is something that is absolutely being planned and is in the works. So just as you have a risk model associated with your driving, just like you have a risk model associated with your use of credit, you will have a risk model associated with everything that you do. What you eat, how you exercise, what you watch, your political viewpoints, what you put out into social media. All of that information will be used to create a very, very, very concise report on each individual person, just like there is very, very concise information that is put into each person's driving record and FICO score. It's not impossible. And people say, oh, that's a daunting task. Well, what does that represent? That represents money for people who are willing to undertake that task. So at QUX, what we do is say, no, you know, we don't subscribe to that theory that you should be, first of all, you are a sovereign private individual, and you should have a right to engage in your life without every aspect of your being now being surveilled and aggregated and targeted and collected and sold.
Very interesting. And Keith, that sounds like a great product. I'm going to have to check into that. How do we find out more? Follow online, get in touch, all that, please.
Well, I am not, and I just said, talking about social media, I am not a social media guy. Don't care. I would recommend that people get the hell off of social media. Your life would probably be a lot better if you actually did break that addiction. Too, by the way, social media companies, which give you something for free because you're the product. So you're not going to find me on social media because I'm not on social media and I don't care. But if you want to know more about QUX, QUXnow.com, that's QUXnow.com, and QUXpay.com, that's QUXpay.com. And that'll give you at least a little bit of an introduction as to who we are, what we do, and I think why people are going to start recognizing the importance of what we do in the very, very near future.
Thank you for that and excellent information about the Israeli situation. I appreciate you being with us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks again.
And we'll be right back.
You know, I couldn't do my job properly. I really couldn't. And I'm just so grateful when I found those, or they found me, the Strauss Heart Drops. Truly changed my life and, you know, improved it tremendously. I had energy like I felt like I'd never had before. Within 3 or 4 months, I thought I was Superman. You know, it's hard to describe how invigorating it is when you increase your blood flow and have had restrictions. So I've taken it right to this day. I've taken, I don't know, 150 bottles of Strauss Heart Drops or more. I never want to have any restrictions or blockages again. That was horrible. But I was just thinking when I was waiting for you this morning, your call, the work and back to that time when my boys were young, you know, when I had that attack, my oldest was, I don't know, 13 or 14, down to 8 or 9 years old, my 4 boys. And I was thinking how life would have been different for them had I not found those heart drops. You know, what I did do, Jim, was prepared to die. I got everything out of my name and thought I would be the youngest Elliot to pass with heart disease. There was a lot of them went in their 50s, and I was in my 30s, and I didn't even think about investigating anything natural. I was just so lucky that a friend called me to say he'd had a heart attack. He lived out in the West Coast. He'd moved out to the West Coast. And in fact, I saw him on this cross-country run, had a visit with him. It was very nice. Boy, had he not called me to tell me his good news, that had the heart attack and then using the Strauss heart drops, the doctor canceled his open heart surgery. And I said, give me the name and number. I called that day and got a bottle. By the time I was done that first bottle, I was so enthused that I bought 100 bottles, did my own little study. And that was proved out to be, I wasn't just a lucky one. It was these heart drops were incredible.
Can you explain, Wayne, how they do their magic? How
There's aged garlic oil. And that's really the secret, is aging that garlic oil.
You said?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and that's the real magic is aging the garlic for precisely the right time. Ingredients like cayenne pepper, hawthorn berries and leaves, motherwort, white willow bark, they just work so well. It was unbelievable. The first thing that happened to me in 2 weeks taking them, the hearing returned to my left ear so that I could actually hear what someone was saying rather than just hearing noise. I had no idea that was cholesterol, caused by cholesterol. I really didn't. And then my bronchial cleared, got rid of a lot of stuff. And then the energy, boy, after 5-6 weeks. Hard to describe, really, how invigorating it is as it, dissolves that plaque. And my blood cholesterol level, this is interesting, almost tripled for a year. That's how plugged up I was. And my doctor, he was freaked out about it. And in the meantime, I felt like Superman. And we call this, in the natural health business, we call this the cholesterol myth, that high blood cholesterol is an issue. Cholesterol is an issue when it's stuck somewhere, restricting blood flow, floating in your blood. Your body could be working perfectly, and it's just moving any excess cholesterol. Your liver makes it because we need it, the cholesterol. But any excess, just like if you eat too many apples or cherries, you know, what your body can't use, you get rid of in the washroom. So, my blood cholesterol level. See, they would never have suggested pills to me, Jim. Here's the funny thing. Well, it's not funny. It's sad, really. But my blood, according to the doctor, my blood cholesterol level was perfect. Never suggested those statin drugs or blood thinners to me. 8 out of 10 heart attack victims have low blood cholesterol, not high. 8 out of 10. It's a landslide, 80%. That's because it's the cholesterol, the plaque is stuck somewhere, restricting or blocking blood flow. It's not floating in your blood. So it's in my opinion, with all my heart, I believe this, of course, after all these years and the experience I've had, that is the biggest myth in the medical business, is that blood cholesterol is a danger. You know, 8 out of 10 heart attack victims having low blood cholesterol like me, it appears that's the danger. And of course they can't, when they take your blood, they can't tell what's stuck. You'd need to have the most popular and dangerous is the angiogram, where they go into an artery, often in your groin, put dye into you, and then they can see on the x-ray where blockages are and how severe. The other is, I believe it's like an ultrasound test, like a CAT scan, where they can see But high blood cholesterol really has nothing to do with heart disease.
Okay, that's kind of shocking or so counterintuitive.
It sure is. Well, especially since everybody hangs so much importance on it. And my doctor was actually worried when we have a different scoring scheme in Canada than you do in the United States. So 3.0 was perfect. That's when I had the heart attack. When I took the Strauss heart drops, mine went to 8.1 for about a year as it continued to work. And I just felt stronger and stronger, more and more energy. And I tried to get my doctor to take them, Jim. I gave him a bottle. Next time I went to see him, I used to go for blood pressure checks and things like that. And when I took the heart drops, I got a blood sheet, a sheet to go get my blood tested. Because by my thinking and talking to Jim Strauss, as there was less cholesterol in my blood, as my numbers went down, it would mean to me I was getting closer to being cleaned out. And that's exactly how it worked. So I tried to have my doctor take it. He's a wonderful man, hardworking man. Our small town never had enough doctors. And he just couldn't get his head around it. I used to be very open with him. I really thought the world of this man. And I'd tell him he looked like hell and you're working hard and you don't look good. Well, then he had the heart attack. I couldn't wait to see him afterwards. In Canada, when a doctor has a heart attack, he's flown by helicopter to a hospital. Because we're short doctors right across the country. And when I saw him, he came back to work. Boy, he looked terrible, which I told him. I brought him the third bottle of heart drops that I had given him. He opened his desk and I could see he hadn't opened the other two. And I said, Doc, what is it? I don't understand this. You've seen me come back to life. Whoa, what is it that bothers you? And he said, well, if cholesterol in the blood isn't a problem, then why is sugar in the blood a problem? And I said, come on, Doc, cholesterol, plaque from cholesterol and sugar are not the same things to start with. So, I don't know how to answer that. But the poor man, he quit doctoring. He quit his practice a couple of months later. Those heart drops, I mean, it was just, I almost stopped sleeping. And when Jim Strauss, he would come and live with my family twice a year for a month. We did lectures and radio shows and so forth. We were very close. He would say, Wayne, you have to sleep. You can't. I don't care how much energy you have. Nobody can get away without sleeping, which, of course, is true. I was foolish. I thought, this is great. I sleep an hour or two here and there, and I can work so much. But that was foolish. I was just lucky that I got away with that. To this day, for many years, I've been a 3, 4, 5 hour sleeper. The energy though that I felt was, it really is impossible to describe properly, Jim, from where I went from to having this incredible energy. And I never once got out of bed, even after an hour or two sleep, where when my feet didn't hit the floor, I was ready to go. I've never got up and said, Jason, I'm tired. I've worked hard sometimes and got home and said, boy, I'm whacked out today. But it's just, I can't say enough about those heart drops and what they've done for me. And if somebody was silly enough to give me a football helmet, I'd probably put it on today and I'd be 71 in a couple of months. It's changed my life. The most important thing that's ever happened in my life. And my relationship with Jim Strauss was definitely the most profound relationship I've had in my life. So I was just thinking about that today, and now I've been called to do this very important job with regards to ships. As I was waiting for you, I was thinking, Jesus, what a difference it would have been had I not found the heart drops, had another heart attack, died like so many people do. My boys were young. It would have changed their lives. Look at all I would have missed. My goodness, that was 36 years ago I had that heart attack. So I'll remain forever grateful, that's for sure, Jim. And it's, you know, the beauty is it's been painless, absolutely painless, taking an herbal formula every day. And I've noticed I have some weakness in my prostate now, so I've been taking the Strauss prostate formula for about a month, and it's working. And it turns out Jim Strauss was correct. Everything our bodies need has been provided by nature. And when we were created by the Creator, of course, there were no man-made chemicals. So it's the way nature intended it. And I haven't had so much as an aspirin in 30 years now, and I never intend to. So,
Tell us about the ship. Tell us about the ship that you've been referring to in the new project. Tell us about that.
Well, it's just I can't say too much, of course, but it's a very, very large yard, and have some real problems. And since I'm the world's probably oldest in more ways than one, but the oldest active ship recycler in the world, they called me and asked me if I'd come down and help them out with these problems. It's not rocket science, this shipbreaking business, but as my dad taught me many years ago, there are a dozen or so cardinal rules that you just don't break. And so I'm kind of looking forward to it, you know.
What are those rules?
I always like to, well, rules like tying a ship up as though a hurricane is going to come every night. Because the weather, of course, can change quickly, and there's very little quite so scary as a 10,000 ton ship broke loose and floating, and what it can do to bridges or other vessels, or, you know, the damage when you have something of that size and weight that has movement, has force behind it. You know, that ship, I forget where that was now, it wasn't so long ago, it was in the news, very large container vessel lost its steerage and hit that bridge. And I just can't, is it Baltimore maybe?
Baltimore, yes.
Yes. Yeah, tremendous damage. And so, you know, that was one of the rules. You tie a ship up as though you're going to have a storm every night. You don't, never mind what the weatherman says, you tie a ship up properly. You know, that's one of them. The rest are to do with the actual operation itself and breaking the ship. You know, it turns out that, you know, water is your best friend to use inside the ship to displace the weight as you're breaking the ship, to tilt or tip a ship. So the water, you know, usually it's a nightmare. You don't want water inside a working ship, of course, other than potable water and water to cool the engine and so forth. But the water is a great tool when it comes to shipbreaking, to drag vessels out of the water. And so I'm looking forward to this. It's you know, it's right down my alley. It's a bit of a challenge, but I mean, I am looking forward to it. It's been a little while now since I worked with the ships. I've been focused on the health business, and that's going very well. I've really enjoyed this. I think I'm due for my fourth oil change since I left home, Jim. And by the time I get home, there'll be a fifth needed. So I think it's just over 30,000 kilometers we're going to cover in, 2.5 months. And almost,
all because you're afraid of flying.
No, this would be difficult to, I suppose, you could fly from province to province and then get a rental car and drive around to all the stores. But I've driven the whole way. And you know, we're in Ontario. There was 200 stops in province of British Columbia. There was over 100, and now we're in the prairie provinces, less population. So we can see the end of the trip now. It's been quite successful and wonderful meeting these terrific people, caring people in these health food stores. They've welcomed us. It's been very, very nice. meeting all these folks, and I think it's going to help boost business. There's no doubt in my mind. We're taking around products that they're not currently selling, and so that they can try them out and see for themselves how effective they are. And so, yeah, I'm excited about it. Really, my family, in the last month, we bought the rest of the Strauss company from Peter Strauss. He's going to stay with us, of course. He's a master herbalist, a great friend, and I've been running the business side of it for 5 years, and he decided that it's time he'll... So we bought the... We own the entire company now, and I'm excited about that, too.
Let's switch gears a little bit. We only have a couple of minutes left, Wayne. What are your thoughts on the celebrities that talk a big game but don't actually deliver very much? You know, for example, Leonardo DiCaprio talks at the UN about the environment and then gets on a private jet and flies off and spends a month on a private yacht with his latest model girlfriend and has a huge carbon footprint, but yet he's considered a great environmentalist because of that speech that he gave. What are your thoughts on all of the hypocrisy that I see from our celebrities?
Well, I guess, you know, Jim, my mind goes to the politicians that meet in these summits, cost billions of dollars, all the security and so forth. When, with today's technology, I suppose, they could do it on Zoom. They wouldn't have to take 2 years to set it up. Then they arrive and they all make promises, set their goals. Nobody's ever met the goals. I guess mostly because they don't know how to meet the goals. It's just nice talk that makes them look good, I guess, and get the votes of the environmentalists like me that are concerned. So I'm really just frustrated that you know, that really so little meaningful things have been done. I think this business of mandating the electric cars, personally, I think is foolish. Not to say that we don't need to do something. Certainly we do. But we don't have the electricity, or anywhere near it. You know, you have blackouts and brownouts now in the summertime when the air conditioning needs are high. So, you know, it just doesn't exist yet. And here we are headed for this goal. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, the goal. I just don't think it's practical. I just don't think they'll meet it. I guess to the extent that they do is a good thing. I don't think you're ever going to get jet airplanes running on electricity. They do have the world's first few vessels, marine vessels. I don't think you're ever going to have warships or the like running on electricity. So I don't know. You know, the recycling is great. We've made great strides. But in the United States, I mean, boy, has it been slow. It's only been maybe 5 years or so since Florida has recycled containers as well as the garbage containers. You know, there's just so many ways. And unfortunately, Jim, of course, it comes down to cost and money. But I wish these jokers, these politicians that get together every once in a while and make such a big deal about it and cost so much money. The last one in Canada cost $1.5 billion. Took a year and a half to arrange. They even had frogmen in the Vancouver Harbor, you know, to protect these big shots. And you know, they could just do more. I think a lot of it's window dressing We've been talking about it a long time. We've made very few strides. And the other thing is that it's going to be difficult. The consumer always takes it in the end. The cost of electricity over these next few years, from everything I've learned, and I've been involved a little bit in the offshore business of generating electricity with water turbines and wind turbines, I expect the cost of electricity to the consumer will triple, and I would guess by 2030. So, you know, that's quite a burden. As you say, I mean, I guess we need to fly around in airplanes. I don't care for it personally, but that's just one of the few fears I have. I'm driving a truck around the country now. But you know, I think there are other things we can do. Companies, for example, the two big nickel companies in Canada that are now foreign owned, when it was brought to light that, you know, the 50 miles around this town of Sudbury was, everything was dead up in Algonquin Park, one of our famous parks in Ontario. The acid rain was changing the rivers and lakes. And they gave these two nickel producers 10 years to meet the new emission requirements. And they were each spewing out 2,500 tons a day of sulfur dioxide. 2,500 tons a day. So that's the same weight as about 2,000 automobiles every day in what turned into sulfuric acid into the atmosphere. No wonder it killed everything for 50 miles around. So just because a company is big and has a lot of employees and a lot of clout, well, you know, why, to use that as an example, why did they need 10 years? We really got to get serious about some things if we're going to. And then how do we control what China is doing, Jim? For example, I picked China because they're the largest steel maker in the world now. Horrible polluters, absolutely horrid. You know, the Yellow River in China is called the Yellow River because it's yellow. It's true. The city that makes blue jeans denims in China, the river's blue. So they've had, I'm sure they're doing better than they were, but just horrible pollution. And there is no window in the sky that blanks that off from reaching our side of the world. There's no bulkhead in the oceans that stops it and keeps it where it was generated. You know, the water flows around the world just as the air does. And there's really nothing we can do. China is still building coal-burning electric power plants. A few years ago, they were starting one per week, and now they have 4,500 of the world's 8,000 coal-burning plants. So, you know, we can do what we like here. It's really kind of a joke in Canada. There's 35 or 36 million of us, and we've eliminated that, our four coal-burning power plants. But it's like the flea on the elephant's rear end, you know, when you compare it to China with its 1.5 billion or whatever people and all those power plants. So I guess we have to be a little more together in the world. And right now, the communist countries aren't too close to the rest of us. There's so much trouble that I imagine that's the last thing on their mind.
Wayne, we need to wrap it up. I appreciate your time today, and drive safe. We'll talk next week.
You bet. Thanks, Jim. Bye.
We are out of time, but back tomorrow. Be safe, everyone. Take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.